Can I ask questions? Okay, first one, dear Ajahn. So this is about the sutta on volition. I don't really understand how the virtue, non-remorse, joy link works. I feel I've been keeping the precepts pretty well for many years now, and I'm reasonably virtuous, I think. Yet even though I may not be feeling any remorse over my conduct, my mind does not necessarily feel joyful. Sometimes it is overcome by anxiety about things, for example, health, some task I have to do, etc., not about something I did, which I feel rather more joy that is supposed to come naturally from virtue. Other times I might feel bored or annoyed, etc. Can you please explain? Also, what did you mean by nudging the mind? One has to deliberately reflect on one's virtue. Thank you very much. Okay, so remember the idea here of virtue is a very profound idea in Buddhism. It is not just about keeping your precepts, your five precepts or the eight precepts or whatever. It's about deliberately also developing the opposite side of virtue. So virtue means character, it means personality, it means habits, it means all of these things that are an important part of what we are as human beings. So all of these things matter, about your generosity, how you think about other people. And this idea of thinking, how we think about the world, is a very important part of this. So what is your attitude to the people around you? Do you see the positive side, or do you kind of fault find with other people? This is a very important part. Are you able to forgive easily, to see people, to understand that we're all in many ways in the same boat, that life is always difficult for most people, right? We all have our difficulties, we all have our joys, but everybody has their difficulties in life. Are we able to understand other people with compassion, or do we tend to judge too quickly? These are the kind of issues that really makes the difference in this particular link. Virtue in Buddhism, sila, is a very, very profound thing. And it goes down to the very basic aspect of perception, how we see the world, how we look upon the world. Look at the world in the right way, that is good virtue. Look at the world in the wrong way, and it is it's not going to work for you. So non-remorse does not just mean, as I said before, that you feel, you think of yourself, oh, I did something bad, or anything like that. It is just the darkening of the mind, the lack of mindfulness, the lack of joy, the lack of brightness, the dimming of the lights inside that happen as a consequence of not doing the right thing all the time. Yeah, and the opposite, if you continuously practice virtue in the right way, if you take this to the, bring in all of these aspects of virtue, the mental virtue, the positive side of things, as well as avoiding the negative side, it's like you're turning up the lights inside. The mind becomes bright, the mindfulness arises, you feel the energy, all of these things come together. So the practice of virtue in Buddhism is a very it's very demanding, if you like. It takes a lot of commitment to be able to do this. And this is why one of the things that I will talk about the most here on this retreat is especially how to use our minds in such a way that you develop those positive states of mind rather than the negative ones. Because this is, for many people, the biggest conundrum. How can we possibly have compassion for other people all the time? How can we possibly see their good points when there are so many negative things to see? Aren't we lying to ourselves if we see all the good points and we kind of neglect the bad ones? So these are the kind of things I want to deal with on this retreat, so we can change our attitudes and change the way of looking at things. And this is what Buddhism kind of specializes in, right? Is the mental cultivation, how to look at the world in a different and a new way. This is what it's all about, really. So look at all of those things and see if you find any weaknesses in there. Don't be fault-finding of yourself either. Don't think that just because you aren't perfect that you are a bad person. That would certainly be the wrong way of going about this. Everybody here is already really wonderful. I mean, how can you get people who are much more wonderful to come on retreats, keep the 8 precepts, practice meditation, try to be kind to themselves and other people? Wow, it's amazing to have people like this coming together in a group like this. Absolutely marvelous. So that is kind of the starting point. It's already marvelous. Now you want to make it even more marvelous, right? That is really what this is all about. So we want to build up marvelousness and make it as marvelous as possibly we can. That's the idea here. So what I mean by nudging the mind is that the idea of meditation practice is to be fairly passive. You want to sit back, you want to enjoy, you want to relax, you want to allow mindfulness to kind of arise pretty much by itself. And then you find yourself maybe being a bit tense, right? Maybe you feel you can't relax 100%. It's a very common thing if we live stressful lives. You can't relax fully. So what you do is you nudge your mind towards some kind of perception that allows you to relax more. Right? Sometimes you can think of yourself as your little child, and to make a little child hush, you're very gentle and nice and kind to that little child. And you think of yourself in that way. So you kind of, almost like you embrace yourself in a kind and gentle way, in a caring way. These are just ways of giving rise to the appropriate perceptions. This is not, this is really what it's all about. And when those appropriate perceptions arise, that is when you start to really relax. Or you nudge your mind towards thinking about something in the past. You remember something beautiful, some nice event in the past, when you did an act of kindness, an act of generosity, that really touched you. You felt really good about that. So you just gently put your mind on that object and see what happens. And if you do that in the right way, you may feel some gladness inside, some happiness arising. And then when that gladness comes, you really relax because you feel good about yourself. Control. The reason why you might feel not 100% relaxed is because the mind is still controlling the body. When you feel happiness, you can usually let go of that control. No need to control anymore. So you relax as a consequence. So you nudge the mind towards the right perceptions. And this is really all you have to do very often. So this is just the idea here, is to minimize the willpower, minimize the amount of effort that we do, very gently moving about. Exactly. So deliberately reflecting on one's virtue, that is a good thing to do, but just very gently. Not too much force. If you use too much force, you will destroy that that goodness that comes out of that kind of reflection. Okay, let's move on to the next one. Good evening, Ajahn Brahmali. The 5 paths, pathways, actually 4, to superpowers. How important are they on the path to awakening? Meaning, are they a must-have? Thank you. Totally enjoying the teachings. Okay, that's great. So the four paths to superpowers, how important are they? Well, they kind of develop by themselves as you go through the practice. I must admit, I've never focused all that much on them myself. These are ways of developing samadhi. But really, if you keep on watching the breath and you allow yourself to get into samadhi by watching the breath, then these things are, in a sense, developed by the wayside. They just happen. Because they are just aspects of samadhi, how to move towards samadhi. So these are, vimamsa samadhi is one of them. So you use investigation to achieve samadhi. One of them is virya samadhi. The energy drives you towards samadhi because you have a lot of energy inside. But you don't have to worry too much about them because they kind of come as a consequence of the rest of the practice. So I have never really focused too much on them. Perhaps I should. Perhaps that's a mistake. But that's what I haven't done that. So I'm sure. I guess you can go a long way without, probably, hopefully, without focusing on those things. Okay, Ajahn Brahmali, could you please explain how to develop non-remorse? We might have to develop non-remorse. Okay, so be kind, right? Be incredibly kind. Not just a little bit kind. Extremely kind. Every thought you have, every intention you have, every perception you have, if everything you do is an aspect of kindness, then you will have no remorse later on. And this is one of those, I think, critical things on the path. The more you understand the power of virtue, the power of kindness, the power of having a soft and gentle heart inside, the more you understand that, the more that kind of sinks inside, the more mindfulness you will have to be aware of that in your daily life. If you realize that this is the most critical thing that happens in your entire life, then your mindfulness will be there, much more there than it will be on, you know, all kind of other silly things that we do in our daily life. Everything in life is about where we put our priority, what is really important to us. And if kindness has the absolute number one priority, that is where your mindfulness will tend to hang out. That will enable you to be even more kind. Yeah, and as you do that, then non-remorse starts to happen. Another aspect of non-remorse, of course, is to be able to forgive yourself. The way to forgive yourself is to understand that we are all conditioned by all of these phenomena. Sometimes we have much less control of our lives than we would like to think, perhaps, or that it feels like. And when you understand how little control you have, how conditioned you are by the past, by your past lives and all of these kind of things, and you are like a puppet, and the master, the strings were pulled many lifetimes ago, and now you're just kind of following on with emotions of those that program that was written many lifetimes ago, and now you're like this robot going through the motions, getting angry here, getting desire there, oh no, saying the wrong thing. You don't have much choice very often. You're just running on this program. The more you understand that, the more easy it is to forgive yourself, because you are not really a master of yourself quite in the way that it feels like. But that forgiveness can never be 100%. And the reason why the forgiveness cannot be 100% is that sense of self that is inside of us. The sense of self will always take some degree of ownership over the things that we do. And because it takes ownership, you will always feel some degree of responsibility for the acts that you do. Because you feel some degree of responsibility, you cannot forgive yourself 100%. And this is why it is so important to cultivate the virtue, avoid the bad things, do the good things. As you do that, non-remorse will happen. Your mind will brighten up. You will sit down and meditate, and whoa, suddenly things come together in a very nice way. Okay, good luck. See what happens. Okay, dear Ajahn. Can you please elaborate more on the more refined ways one can purify one's virtue beyond the five precepts, especially regarding purifying our mental actions? Thank you. I can, and as I said before, this will be a main theme on this retreat, but a lot of the purification of virtue is even before you get to the mental purification, is actually about doing acts of kindness in daily life, right? Having that sense of metta, a sense of goodwill, the sense of friendliness towards the people around you, even people you may not particularly like, or at least people who are neutral in your life, right? Even be friendly towards them. We all, on this, we all kind of have roughly the same problems in life, roughly the same happiness as in suffering. And remember that people usually appreciate kindness when they receive that. So that is really the first thing, to act with kindness. Say things of kindness, do little things that are possible during ordinary life. We can all improve that. I know I can certainly improve that in my life, and we can all improve in that area. But then once you, beyond that, yes, the idea is to change mentally as well. And the most important thing to change mentally is to reduce the amount of ill will and negativity that we have, and to move towards kindness and compassion instead. This is by far the most important one. The sensual pleasures, I wouldn't worry too much about that, because they're not such a major deal. The ill will is far more important. That is what we need to focus on. And I will talk much more about that later on. But the idea is to understand, one of the ideas, to understand people are complicated. people have many sides to them. They have negative sides, they have positive sides. And sometimes all you have to do is to focus on the positive sides of other people. And when you see that, you can let go of the negative stuff. Yeah, it's like when you come on a retreat like this and you hang out with all of these people, and sometimes they do really bad things, right? They should not be doing that. They should know better than doing that little silly thing here. But then you remember the big picture. You remember that people who come here, almost by definition, they're going to be good people. Nobody would come here unless they were a good person. So once you remember that big picture, you can actually let go of those little things. They're only tiny little things. What do they matter? Who knows what the reason for doing those things are? We can never really judge anyone else. We can't really judge ourselves even. It's so hard to understand ourselves. So how can we judge anyone else? And once you focus on that big picture, once you remember all the wonderful qualities, and a lot of people have many beautiful qualities in this world, remember that. Then you can let go of the other stuff. You can just forget about it completely, because that other side is what really matters. Sometimes people think that is being unrealistic. I'm not really taking on board the whole person. I'm just seeing the good sides. That is not being really, I want to be a realistic person. I want to see everything that is there. I don't want to kind of pretend that these things are not there and kind of hide, right? But the point is, there is no such thing as realism. There is no actual reality. All we see is different aspects of somebody. What that person actually is like is impossible to know, because they have many sides that we have never seen, perhaps. There's all kind of stuff going on which is impossible for us to judge. All we do is that we have a few kind of fragments of their life that we are aware of. Even our own life is impossible to judge sometimes. So because all we have is an unrealistic picture anyway, rather than think that we are going to choose reality, what instead we do is to choose those things that are useful. Yeah, that is the only way to approach this. We ask ourselves, well, what actually is useful? What is beneficial for myself? What is beneficial for the other person? That is the best way to go about choosing our perceptions, how to look at other people. There is no reality. Forget about reality. Reality is kind of possible to grasp. It slips between your fingers before you have even kind of touched it at all. And then instead, ask yourself, what is a useful perception? And the useful perception is always to see the goodness in other people. And then that becomes beneficial both for yourself and also for the other person. Anyway, that's just a slight introduction in how to work with the mind. This is actually very fascinating. I find this all this very, very interesting. And I will hopefully talk more about this as we go along here. Okay. Azan. At 5 a.m. in the morning, quite a number of people came to meditate. Can someone switch on the heating and bring the heating to at least 22 degrees? Oh, very specific requirement. Wayne, are you able to do that? Can you? Yeah? Excellent. So Wayne, he's very reliable. So if he says he can do it, it means it will happen. That is great. Okay, good. Yes, I heard that there was one of the people coming from Singapore who was very concerned about the temperature in Australia. Oh, they thought it might get very, very cold in Australia. But sometimes the aircon in Singapore is colder than the temperature in Australia. So it's not such a bad thing. But anyway, so hopefully we will. I think it's very important that everybody is comfortable in here. So if we can do that, that would be a wonderful thing here. Okay. How do you stay mindful and in the moment when your body keeps distracting you with aches and pains? Yes, that is an important thing. Of course, the first thing to do, as I was saying before, is to find a posture for yourself that is as comfortably as you can, right? Something that will last you roughly for the time of your meditation. So find a posture for yourself that is nice and easy. Don't force yourself to sit in one way all the time. If you feel halfway through your meditation that it is becoming very difficult, change that posture. Sit in on your little bench, sit cross-legged, sit on a chair, lean against the wall, go out walking, whatever it takes. I would recommend you to try to follow the schedules, only move out of the room at the, you know, at the hours when it says on the schedule. Otherwise, it can be very distracting for people. But if you really have to, and you really are, it's getting difficult for you. Of course, you can always leave if that is the case. But try first of all to change your posture a little bit. Try to sit on a chair. Just get up very gently. Sit on a chair instead. And this is really the best way of overcoming the pain. Remember, this is not a competition on who can sit on the floor the longest, right? If you get into that mind state, it becomes very counterproductive, the whole path. It is really about yourself and about your development and your mind. And if you practice in the right way, you are going to develop much faster. So just focus on yourself. Forget about everybody else. Everybody else, they do their own thing. You do your thing. What everybody else thinks is their business. You just do what works for you. And then hopefully you can find some ease in the body. If you still have pains and aches in the body after moving, maybe you have some chronic problem or whatever, then you're going to have to deal with it in a different way. And you're going to have to try to be mindful of that pain and of those problems. That is the only way if there are chronic pains. So you're going to have then to learn to accept the reality. This is the reality of my body. I can't do anything about it. I've done everything I can. Of course, you are allowed to take some medicines if that helps. I don't know if you have some maybe slight painkillers that don't disturb the meditation too much. That's perfectly okay. Otherwise, you're going to have to try to accept the pains. And Ajahn Brahm tells a very interesting story that you probably have all heard. When he was in Thailand, he said he had this terrible toothache, because in Thailand in those days there were no dentists, right? So he had a really bad toothache. You just had to endure. And that's what he did. And he said that he didn't know what to do with his toothache. It was getting really, really, really bad. Until eventually there was no way out. And he just sat down and decided, giving up completely. And the moment he gave up completely, he gave up all desire, all craving for that toothache to get better. I mean, really completely. Right? This is Ajahn Brahm. He really knows how to give up sometimes. He gave absolutely completely, and the toothache vanished like that. It's kind of astonishing. And this shows us that the greatest problem by far with pain is our attitude to it. If you're able to accept it for what it is, you can bring up some mindfulness, and that mindfulness arises. You get the distance to the pain. It's almost as if you're observing the pain as something almost foreign to yourself. At that point, it becomes far easier to bear. Then it becomes even an object of your meditation itself. This is what you have to do then. But in the meantime, I would suggest to you, if you can avoid pain, far better, because it's can be very difficult to deal with it otherwise. Remember, middle way, right? The Buddha didn't say torture yourself. He said be kind to yourself, I suppose. Did he say that anywhere? Well, he kind of implied be kind to yourself. Okay. Okay, so this next question. How does one quieten the monkey mind that keeps creeping through the back door? That's the story. Goes out here and roaming around in the forest, yeah? Okay, so this is a problem that almost very many people have. The mind is wandering around, being restless, being agitated, a very, very common problem in meditation. And the way to quieten it down, there are many, many things that you can do here. The first thing is just to allow the monkey mind to be. Learn to just sit there with the monkey mind. Allow it to be. One of the most important skills in meditation is to learn to be the passive observer. We just are aware of what is going on. No control. No trying to do anything at all. This is already quite hard because we are such notorious doers. Human beings, we identify with our ability to do things, to control things. And because it is a very important part of our identity, it's actually very hard to stop. Because it's as if our identity itself is threatened. Yeah, so just learning to be peaceful and still and to be a passive observer and allowing things to be, already you're going a long way. So try that first of all with your monkey mind. Yeah, monkey mind is, by the way, is okay. It's okay to have monkey mind. You don't have to feel bad about that. Everybody has a bit of a monkey mind sometimes. Especially monks, they certainly have a monkey mind sometimes. Monkeys. So just allow it to be. This is the first thing here. Then if this is a persistent problem, remember that the thing that drives the mind towards unity, that allows the mind to settle down, is to enjoy the meditation experience. And this is why the joy and happiness is such a central part of the meditation experience, because when the joy arises, you have something that is far more precious, far more interesting than the thinking, the mind wandering here and there. This is why the Buddha uses a lot of effort in the suttas to explain to us how to give rise to that joy. And that joy can arise simply from sitting down, watching the breath. Sometimes joy comes from that. Other times we have to more deliberately cultivate it by sitting back, feeling, you know, having a sense of metta for the people around you, reflecting on your past virtue, reflecting of generosity, feeling what an amazing thing it is to be a disciple of the Buddha. The Buddha, this astonishingly wise, compassionate teacher who lived 2,500 years ago, whose teaching are still available, and we are disciples of this person. Whoa! Once you get into that, whoa! It is just so wonderful to have the wisest person in history being your teacher, isn't it? What an amazing thing that is. And once you get into that feeling for who the Buddha was, what his character was like, what his wisdom was like, how he treated people, how he was thinking about us 2,500 years ago, I'm going to talk about all of those things later on. Once you get into that, you feel so fortunate, you feel so blessed to be able to be part of this teaching and to be able to practice this path, which leads to the answer to the very meaning of life itself. That is astonishing. That is remarkable. And just that feeling can give rise to joy. So these are some of the ways to give rise to that wholesome kind of joy. And that is where the monkey mind starts to become very quiet. You don't want the monkey mind anymore. You throw it out. Go away, monkey. And welcome happiness instead. So try some of those things and see what happens. But remember, a lot of the problem with the monkey mind is precisely because we haven't really practiced our sila yet for long enough or deeply enough and all of these kind of things. The sila is the foundation for meditation. That was one of the things I was talking about before today. Once that sila becomes really profound, it includes the thinking mind, the perceptions, the intentions, body, speech and mind, positive and negative, that is when this really starts to come together here. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, please kindly explain again viraga in this morning sutta. Thank you. Okay, so viraga, the meaning of viraga. Viraga has two meanings in the suttas. One is fading away. So when things fade away, you have viraga. So in your meditation, you sit down, and things start to fade away, the body starts to fade away, the monkey mind starts to fade away, less thinking, the defilements start to fade away, hopefully. That is viraga in one sense of the word, things fading away. But also, viraga also has this meaning of loss of craving or desire for things, right? Because when you, in this morning sutta, we looked at the word nibbida, which means like having a sense of repulsion towards things in the world because you see the problem in them. You don't want to have anything to do with them anymore, so you get slightly repelled by all of those things. And that repulsion leads to a non-interest. And then the desire, the craving starts to fade away and disappear as a consequence. So here it means more like the fading away of desire or even the disappearance of desire. Viraga is the opposite of raga. Raga means desire, essentially. Sensual desire, these kind of things. This is the opposite of that. the complete ending of those things. And that then leads to vimutti, because the vimutti is the liberation from that craving, and therefore also the liberation from suffering itself. These are the two meanings of viraga, and sometimes they overlap a little bit, fading away and non-desire. Ooh, here is a short essay, so we will then take it. Well, this is really using paper really well. Three questions in one, okay? Dear Ajahn, I heard a story like this. The Lord Buddha discussed with Venerable Ananda about his parinibbana two times, hoping he would be requested to postpone his parinibbana until the Buddha reaches the age of 120 years. Venerable Ananda did not get the message. Only on the third time, Venerable Ananda realized what he missed out. Venerable Ananda did request to postpone Nibbana, but the Buddha declined, saying it is too late. Please confirm. Thank you, with metta. Yes, there is such a story in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the same sutta we were looking at this morning, which is the Buddha's final passing away. And it is a very strange passage indeed, in my opinion. I can't really make heads nor tails of this particular passage. The Buddha asking Venerable Ananda, or telling Venerable Ananda, how does it go again now? He's hinting to him, Ananda, said that the Buddha could live on for an eon if he wanted to. And Ananda doesn't get the hint, right? And he says it again. Ananda still doesn't get the hint. And then the Buddha said, oh, well, now it's too late. Sorry, you missed your chance. You missed your opportunity to ask. So it's kind of weird, isn't it? What's going on there? And to me, it almost sounds like some kind of excuse, some kind of story that has been made up later on to somehow find an excuse for the Buddha to give up his life faculty so that he can kind of, come to the end of his life. That's what it sounds like to me. Is that how the Buddha ends his life? He kind of gives a hint to Ananda. If Ananda doesn't get the hint, then he doesn't. It's strange, isn't it? Not only that, but actually, it says in that sutta that Venerable Ananda, he was possessed by Mara, right? So Mara is like the idea is like the incarnation, if you like, of desire and incarnation of delusion and that sort of thing. Yeah. So Ananda was possessed by Mara. The Buddha would have known that, right? Who else would have known that? Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the sutta, presumably. And despite knowing that, he asks him a question that he knows he can't possibly answer in the right way because he's possessed by Mara. And then afterwards, he blames him for getting it wrong. Right? It makes absolutely no sense. And I find it very, very hard to believe that actually is what happened. And this is one of the things about the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. It includes a lot of narrative, a lot of story. And that story, remember, very often is not part of the earliest part of Buddhism. The earliest part of Buddhism is the actual word of the Buddha himself. When the Buddha gives a discourse, when the Buddha says something, that is the earliest part of Buddhism. These stories would have been created at some later time. When would they have been created? They would have been created maybe around the first council, the first communal recitation that happened after the Buddha passed away, when all the arahants came together and they recited the text to pass it on for posterity. That is where these things were laid down. It specifically says that in the first council. They ask the reciter, where did this take place, right? And of course, that where is exactly what we now find in the narrative part of the suttas. So we know that it was laid down later on. The narrative is a later part of it. And this particular thing, I think, was laid down later on. And I think the reality of how the Buddha passed away is probably much more simple. He was just getting old. When you get old, you die, right? That's what the Buddha says. How could it be that which has been born should not decay and die? That's what we saw this morning when we're reading it. That, to me, is the natural way of understanding the sutta. And this, all of this here, to me, is something I find it very hard to really have much confidence in, to be honest with you. Anyway, I'm a skeptical monk, you see. So I'm anyway, I'm just letting you know the way I look at this. So let us go on to the next one. if you already stuffed up the first part by being unvirtuous in the past and therefore feel regret, how do you move forward? Thank you again, Ajahn. You have never stuffed up, right? Stuffing up is already the wrong attitude to this. We don't stuff up. We act according to conditions. We have been conditioned to do some silly things. And the fact that you are here and you have realized that you made a mistake, whoa, what improvement, right? Yay, you are now on the right track, moving towards something far better. So be really happy about that, the fact that you are now heading in the right direction. This is what really matters. The Buddha gives a beautiful simile of the grain of salt, where he says that if you do a large amount of good actions, it means that the bad actions you do will have very little result later on. So it doesn't matter if you stuffed up in the past. If you keep on living life rightly from now on, that will gradually fade away into the past. Eventually, it won't have any effect on you at all anymore. You will be able to forgive yourself. You will be able to let go of that mistake or mistakes or whatever it was in the past. And eventually, it will be completely gone from your life. Just keep on doing the right thing, and it will disappear, and then there will be no problems there. Everybody stuffs up in the past, right? I have certainly stuffed up in the past myself, and I'm sure everyone here has done some stuff-ups in their past. It's impossible to live a human life without sometimes stuffing up. So it's okay. Forgive yourself. Move on. You were a victim of circumstances in your life. You may not even be able to see that right now, but eventually you will see that. And then you can forgive, let go, move forward. And wow, you'll be on the highway to Nibbana. That was a wonderful thing that is. Okay. Ajahn Brahmali, how can I truly enjoy walking meditation and gain its benefits? What was the context that the Buddha introduced walking meditation? Thank you. So, the Buddha doesn't really introduce walking meditation so much. He doesn't really. What we see in the suttas is that we see how sometimes the Buddha and the monks, they will be walking up and down, doing chankama. Chankama is the Pali word for this, walking back and forth. And it doesn't really say exactly what they do when they do that. So it is really up to us to kind of fill in the details for walking meditation. But basically, there is no limit to what you can do in walking meditation, as long as you do something wholesome, something positive. One of the things I would recommend you to do when doing walking meditation is just to enjoy walking back and forth, not doing anything in particular. But especially because you sit here, you know, many hours every day, perhaps trying to focus, even though we say you shouldn't really try too hard. It's still very difficult not to try sometimes. So still, we tend to kind of put too much pressure on ourselves. So when you do walking meditation, sometimes just go out and enjoy walking back and forth. Don't do anything at all in particular. I remember this was the advice I heard from a famous Burmese meditation master many years ago. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. All you have to do is just walk back and forth and enjoy yourself. I'm going to do that. And actually, it's very nice. And you just enjoy the peace. You enjoy being here at Jhana Grove. You enjoy kind of, you know, hanging out with the kangaroos and whatever else it is. And it just becomes very nice just doing that. And by doing that, what you are doing is that you are letting go of some of the striving and the will that tends to creep into meditation when you sit for many hours every day. It is very, very difficult actually to be completely patient and allow things to be absolutely. We tend to use willpower, we tend to use our mind too much. So to kind of counteract that a little bit, when you go outside, just walk back and forth and enjoy that. Unless, of course, your meditation is going incredibly well and you are blissing out and everything is going so nicely. If that is the case, then when you do walking meditation, you can focus on your feet as you're moving back and forth. But only if your meditation is going really, really well. You're experiencing a lot of happiness and bliss and all these kind of things. Then you can focus on your feet as you go back and forth. Have 20, 30 paces, which is kind of nicely marked on both ends, and walk back and forth between those points, and just focus on the sensation in your feet. And that will then be a continuation of the meditation that you do when you're sitting down. Or another nice thing you can do while you're walking is you can do contemplation. You can just think a little bit about the suttas, right? Maybe reflect on some of the things that you heard while we're doing the sutta readings. Or you can do other kind of contemplations about impermanence. We saw one of the beautiful contemplations this morning. Everything that is dear and agreeable to me must become otherwise. That is already a very powerful contemplation. If you remember that, this is an impermanence contemplation. It actually makes you let go a little bit of worldly things when you think about these things. Another powerful one is the death contemplation. Remember that you're going to die. See what that does to your mind. If you feel that you have a lot of craving, you can't really settle down, you feel agitated or whatever, remember you're going to die. What's the point of thinking about all this nonsense when you're going to die? Maybe you never leave Dharna Grove, right? Maybe this is your last stop. What a wonderful thing it would be to die here. Wouldn't that be great? Yeah, die at Dharna Grove. Okay, then you have a good kind of starting point for your next life. I'm not suggesting that you should die here, but there must be. I'm sure there will be a first person who dies at Dharna Grove. I'm sure that will happen one of these days. Maybe it will be me. Maybe I will be the first person who dies at Dharna Grove. So anyway, it's just the idea that life is always uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen next. And because of that, death contemplation can be very useful as well. So these are things you can do. You can do metta while you're doing back and forth. You can just watch your mind. Walk back and forth. Watch your mind. What is my biggest problem? Where do I have what are my kind of bad defilements that I need to deal with? Maybe you have certain people that you find are hard to deal with in the world. This might be a good opportunity to deal with those people now while you're here, right? And then forgive them, let go of that, understand that they are their own worst enemy or whatever it is. Deal with that, get it out of the way. And then it's easier to confront them, or not confront them, that's kind of the wrong word, but to meet them again whenever you have to meet them later on. So try some of those things and see what happens. All of these things are the sort of things that lead to less defilements, etc. Okay, dear Ajahn, I feel like I've hit a plateau in my meditation and can't seem to go beyond feeling calm after each session to those described earlier. Okay, you've only been here one day, right? So you relax, chill, be patient. Yeah? Could you share some pointers on how to break this so there can be further improvements? Okay, so what you have to do is you just have to, if you feel that you are kind of hitting a plateau, you can't go any further, that's okay. You just have to try again the next session, see what happens. Sometimes you get the right perception arising in your meditation, and when that right perception arises, the meditation will go deeper because of that. This is one of the reasons why I recommend you after each meditation to ask yourself what perception worked, how the perceptions affected your meditation, because after a while you start to understand how you work your mind so that actually meditation starts to happen. What is the perception I need? And you will see that what you will see is basically that when I have a perception of gentleness, of kindness, of metta, of compassion, right, for everyone here and the whole world ideally, that is when things start to become really easy and light. All those positive perceptions is what drive, they are the ones that drive the meditation practice. This is what you start to see here. If you feel that you are plateauing too much and that you are getting a bit frustrated, don't push yourself too much, because the pushing is going to make it probably more difficult. So just chill a little bit. Take a walk in the forest, go back to your room, have a cup of tea, contemplate a bit. What can I do different here, right? Do some other contemplation. Contemplate death, do metta towards somebody. Try to find out what kind of defilements it is that tend to stop you on the path. Do you have problems with anyone in your life? Can you have some metta towards those people instead? How can I understand these people to have compassion towards them? Everybody in the world has their problems. We're all programmed in our own way. Everybody knows that kindness is the path to happiness. Still, people are unable to be kind. wow, it's a shame. People are deluded, don't really know what's going on. Have compassion for them. Change these perceptions in this way. And as you do that, next time you sit down, you will take it one notch deeper. Don't expect that, because if you expect it, then that will become a hindrance in your meditation. Just try it out and see how things go. And then as you do that, things will change. But don't try too hard. Don't frustrate yourself too much, because eventually it will just explode into ill will and negativity. And you will never come back to Jhana Grove ever again, because it was such a terrible experience for you. That would be bad, right? That would be no good. So don't want to go down that way here. But try some of those things. See if it works. And if it doesn't work, then don't know what to do then. Then you have to kind of come back next year and try again next year. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is there anything that is permanent? Okay, let me just do the second half of this one. First of all, joy, rapture, tranquility, pleasure. Do they happen in sequence, i.e. in the same order? How about delight? What is the difference between them? Thanks. Is there anything that is permanent? What about impermanence? Is that impermanent? Is that permanent perhaps? Impermanence? Yeah. So what you can say is that there is a distinction between the phenomena of experience. Anything that you experience directly, right? You experience seeing, hearing, you experience tasting something, you experience maybe mental things when you meditate, thinking, maybe a bit of joy, all of these kind of things. Anything which is experienced directly is impermanent according to the Buddha's teachings. And as you investigate that, you will see that, and eventually one day you will make this profound breakthrough when you see that everything in life, everything we can experience, is impermanent. Yeah, nothing is always there. Nothing is a backdrop to our experience and always present. And this is why we call this one of the characteristics of existence, is the idea of impermanence. But there are laws about this. These phenomena that we observe, they exist according to certain laws. And these laws in Buddhism are called laws like dependent origination, like the three characteristics of existence: impermanence, dukkha, non-self, right? Suffering, non-self, or unsatisfactoriness and non-self. And these laws are not directly experienced. These laws are something we have to kind of figure out from experience. They are like inferred, if you like, or deduced from experience. These laws are permanent. They are always there. But they're not actually directly part of experience itself, if you see what I mean. Yeah, so that is kind of a distinction there. Okay. Do joy, rapture, tranquility, do they happen in sequence, i.e. in the same order? So remember, these are just words, right? I mean, it's a bit random. The Pali words are pamuja, piti, pasaddi, and then sukha. And exactly how we translate these Pali words is a bit kind of, you just have to choose a word that kind of looks like it's fit, like it fits the context. We could maybe put pleasure first and joy last, you know, it's not really... the words are just words, but the experience happens in a certain sequence. How you experience this happens in a roughly in the same way. And that is, you start off with a fairly basic kind of joy, the joy of feeling that you're living well, the joy of feeling that you are enjoying what you're doing. Meditation is going well. Wow, I'm discovering the meaning of life here. I'm really finding something much more profound than I can find in my ordinary life. And then some kind of gladness arises inside of you. Then that gladness becomes more profound, right? The happiness becomes more intense, more powerful. It moves into tranquility. You become really solid in your meditation seat. Don't want to go anywhere else. So that sequence of experience, it tends to be always the same. Sometimes it goes a bit faster. Sometimes there are kind of different things that you perceive as you go along. Sometimes your perceptions are playing with you a little bit, but roughly it is the same sequence. And that is why that sutta is laid down in that way, because we should go through those things in roughly the same way. So what about delight? Delight is just another word, right? It's just these are just words. So don't worry too much about the words. It is what it is pointing to that really matters. That is what you... So you have to feel almost what these words mean in your own experience. Once you feel these things, then you know what these words actually are. Prior to that, they are kind of blank things. You can project anything onto these words. They don't really have any intrinsic meaning in themselves. We have to choose some random translations into English that seem roughly right. That's really all it is. But try to experience these things, and then you get some idea what's going on. Delight is another way of looking at it. Sure, these things are delightful, right? You enjoy these things as you do this. That is certainly correct as well. Okay. Wow, so many questions. Okay. Dear Ajahn, liberation by faith and liberation by wisdom. Kindly explain. This is a reference to, I think, the Saddhanusari and Dhammanusari, or the Saddha Vimutto, and the Panya Vimutto, the Pandi Kayasaki, the Panya, the Saddha Vimutta. What is the third one? Panya Vimutta, is that right? So basically, this seems to be about the dominant faculty when you become a stream enter. This is at the kind of early parts of the path, the dominant faculty that gives rise to stream entry. Some people are more faith oriented, some people are more wisdom oriented, some people have powerful confidence, and that's the joy and the happiness drives the meditation and makes them make a breakthrough to the Dhamma on that basis. Other people need to be more wisdom oriented, more kind of looking at their experience, looking at it again and again, understanding what is going on, seeing the reality of things, and then making the breakthrough on that basis. There's slightly different faculties that are kind of leading the person towards stream entry here. The Noble One, Upposatha, the Noble Ones Upposatha are observed during the new and full moon. So the Upposatha, okay. Any reason why? So basically the Upositas are observed during the full moon. Why? Maybe because of the gravitational forces. I don't know if it has anything to do with the gravitational forces. Maybe it does. I'm not entirely sure. But I think the idea is just that it's very inspiring, right? When the full moon comes out, of course, if you live in the city, you are deprived of these beautiful spectacles of the starry nights and the full moons. This is one of the beautiful things about living in a little kuti by yourself in the forest. You go out at night and you look up, especially here, the southern sky, right? You see the Milky Way all along. The full moon comes out and it lights up the whole forest. It's magical. It's very, very beautiful. And you can imagine in the old days when the monks would live in forest, they would feel very inspired. And often they would sit up perhaps all night, either discuss the Dhamma or they would meditate, and they would feel inspired by the beauty of the forest, by the beauty of nature at that particular time. That, I think, is the main thing, is the inspiration you can draw from some of these natural phenomena. And this is one of the things the Buddha often talks about, not just the Buddha, many of the senior monks as well, the beauty of nature and the enjoyment of the beauty of nature. Because the beauty of nature tends to calm you down and make you peaceful. It's not really exciting. It doesn't lead to any great craving anything, right? You don't go through the forest and crave all kind of stuff when you go through the forest. You tend to become peaceful instead. And this is the beauty of nature. Okay, I'll do one more question and then we will leave the rest for tomorrow. I've been taking too much time for some of these questions, unfortunately, but that's the way it goes. Please close the door in your room quietly. Thank you. Bye. Okay, so yeah, please try to, as a good reminder for everyone, please try to remember that so that you can have compassion for the people around you. And that is always a nice thing. But I don't want to close on that note. Let's do one more, just to kind of... Okay. Ajahn, what is the difference between emotion, feeling, perception, and judgment? how does this all affect meditation with metta? So, these things are all very closely related to each other. Emotion is a bit more varied. Feeling in Buddhism is very basic. Feeling in Buddhism is something is either good, bad, or neutral. If you enjoy something, it's good feeling. If you don't enjoy it, it's bad feeling. If it's kind of neutral, it's neutral feeling. Yeah? That's all there is to it. Emotions are much more varied. You know, you have anger, you have love, you have jealousy, you have envy, all of this kind of stuff. Emotions are kind of, it's almost like the color of the mind in a sense at any particular time. That's emotions. So those emotions will be related to certain feelings. Certain emotions will be positive feelings. Certain emotions will be negative feelings. So there is a relationship between those. On the Buddhist path, we tend to try to develop the positive emotions, the metta, the compassion of these kind of things. And we try to abandon the negative emotions. And all those positive emotions, they will have positive feelings associated with them. Perception is just how we view the world, right? Perception is very important part of our makeup as human beings. How do we differentiate things? How do we make sense of the world? How do we make sense of, you know, red and blue colors, for example? That's perception. We differentiate between those things. So perception is just our ability to make sense of reality. And judgment. Well, judgment is more to do with the will part of the mind. The mind chooses between what is right and what is wrong. So, you know, you make the judgment that you want to come on a retreat to Jhana Grove. That's a good judgment, right? That's a positive one. You come here on retreat. And then sometimes you make a bad judgment. You are judgmental of other people. That's kind of bad judgment. Or you are compassionate and kind when you give people the benefit of the doubt. That's a good judgment. So judgment has to do with intention, to do with the will, to how we use our mind in the world. How does this all affect our meditation? Well, you have to choose, try to steer yourself towards the right emotions, the right perceptions, the right kind of judgments. And the right judgments and the right emotions, the right perceptions are those that give rise to peace, those that give rise to happiness, those that give rise to a sense of ease and joy on the path. These are the right emotions, the right judgments and perceptions. The whole path can be understood as a development of perception. You want to avoid the perceptions that lead to decline. You want to build up those perceptions that lead to growth, right? Because certain perceptions lead to decline, certain perceptions lead to growth. So choosing the right perceptions is actually one of the very important things on the Buddhist path. Choose the right perception is done by yoniso manasikara, wise attention, wise reflection. Reflect wisely, that leads to choosing the right perceptions. This is one of those important things in this practice. Okay, so that is all for tonight. So have a nice night, sleep well, enjoy yourself, have a good rest, and then we'll see you again tomorrow morning. I'll be here again at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Please come whenever you feel it is appropriate. And maybe we can do the Arahang Sammasambuddho as a last thing before we leave for the evening here.